honored and grateful that President Trump has nominated me for the position of administrator.
Please remove, please restore order. The officers, please restore order in the committee room.
EPA Chief Andrew Wheeler's confirmation hearing disrupted by heckler earlier this year. Wheeler was a coal industry lobbyist before being appointed to run the Environmental Protection Agency. Now the agency is reversing an Obama administration ban on a pesticide found to be dangerous to children's health. We'll have more on that coming up. First, another agency might have a leader seemingly hostile to its mission. President Trump is nominating Eugene Scalia as his new Secretary of Labor. Scalia is the son of the late Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. The younger Scalia is a lawyer who represents big business often. He would succeed recently departed Labor Secretary Alexander Acosta, who announced his resignation last week in the fallout from the Jeffrey Epstein scandal. With me now is Ian Colgren. He covers labor, employment, and immigration for Politico. Hi.
Hi. Great to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. Tell us more about Eugene Scalia and his background.
Eugene Scalia, as his name suggests, is quite a conservative guy, very similar to his father. I was just on the phone with one source actually talking about him who knows him, and this person said he is more like his father than he is different than his father. Mm-hmm. He is a member of the Federalist Society, very involved in that, which is, you know, a big influential conservative legal group that has wielded a lot of influence over the Trump administration's picks. We know that he worked on behalf of companies fighting against various workplace lawsuits that they found themselves defending in. And so he fits, the bottom line is he fits pretty neatly with the pattern of the administration wanting deregulation, favoring business in a lot of ways, and as you said, at times selecting people to run these agencies who are at the very least skeptical of the agency's mission and often have a history of going head-to-head with the agencies that they're now running.
Right. So let's talk about the Labor Department in particular. What is its mission? Isn't it to uphold labor laws, enforce labor laws, and protect workers?
The Labor Department was formed in response to pretty bad working conditions in this country that everyone has read about in history books in the early part of the 20th century. And the mission, as you said, is to protect workers in a variety of ways, protect their safety, protect their health, and ensure that there's a baseline standard for people's workplace conditions in the United States.
Right. And so Eugene Scalia in particular, how has he gone up against these regulations in his private practice?
Well, one good example is a case in which he represented Walmart in 2006. There was a Maryland state law that would have required Walmart to pay more money for health care to its employees, and the younger Scalia fought on behalf of Walmart against that state law. He also was blocked, actually, when he was nominated to be the Solicitor of Labor in 2001 in the George W. Bush administration because he opposed an ergonomics rule to protect workers from repetitive motion injuries. And he also was an assistant to Bill Barr when he was Attorney General previously. And so he's very deep in the business conservative world, based on his record.
Right. I believe the Wall Street Journal back in 2012 called him one of the industry's go-to guys for challenging financial regulations. What has he said, if anything, in terms of how he would run the Labor Department or how he feels about running the Labor Department?
Well, he hasn't really said anything so far. His nomination came up remarkably quickly. Everyone thought because the Senate has moved so slow on so many nominations and for a variety of other reasons, that the president really wouldn't pick anyone quickly to fill the position. And there was also an assumption that that person, even if he did pick someone, that they wouldn't get confirmed quickly. But here we are, seemingly overnight, you know, in the span of just a few days, the president chose Scalia. He was seen walking out of the West Wing last night. My colleagues and I broke the story that he was likely going to be selected. And then shortly thereafter, Trump tweeted that and confirmed it. We did reach Scalia last night. He did not comment about his appointment. He didn't really say anything. That's not all too unusual for people who are nominated to cabinet positions. They're largely forbidden from talking until their confirmation hearing comes up. So we'll have to wait and see what he says at his hearing and how he couches his record before the Senate.
And how much of this is about name recognition? Obviously, his famous father, his name is heralded in conservative circles and is really appreciated by President Trump's base, especially for his anti-abortion statements. So how much of this is Donald Trump signaling to his base, I got you with this pick?
It's hard to overstate the star power of the Scalia name in conservative circles. You are absolutely right about that. However, I think even more so than signaling to his base, the president is signaling to the Senate that he's going to pick someone that they cannot vote against. For Republicans in the Senate, he's basically giving them an offer that they can't refuse. You cannot be a Republican senator and vote against someone with the name Scalia. You just can't do it. And the president knows that. His advisors know that. And so certainly it signals that they want a slam dunk pick, both in ideology and also politically, someone who can get through the Senate and somebody who can be a conservative darling. And they've done both of those things with this pick.
So he will be confirmed.
I will eat my hat if he is not confirmed, but you never know. I mean, there could be something that comes up from his past that raises questions. I don't think anybody thought that the Epstein thing initially, that it would ultimately bring down Acosta, but here we are. Right now it's looking like the nomination is going to move fairly quickly, probably not until after the August recess, but it's going to move quickly, and I don't imagine much consternation. I'm sure Democrats will raise their points and speak loudly about who he is. They're already starting to do that a little bit today, but I would have a very hard time believing that he will have any problem getting confirmed.
All right. Ian, thank you.
Thank you.
That's Ian Colgren. He covers labor, employment, and immigration for Politico. All right, let's look at another agency that's being reshaped in the Trump era, the Department of Homeland Security. It's responsible for immigration, border security, also cybersecurity, disaster response. It's a sprawling agency created right after 9/11. But in the Trump era, immigration has become its main focus. And here to talk about how the agency has been transformed is Jason Zengerle, correspondent for The New York Times Magazine. He has a big piece up in this week's issue about DHS. Hi.
Hey, how are you?
Great, thanks. Okay, so this agency in the last couple of years has basically jumped from crisis to crisis, right? It began with the Muslim travel ban that Trump rolled out a few days after he took office. Take us back to that moment and how it kicked off this tension between Trump and his inner circle, including Stephen Miller and the people who were running the DHS at the time, John Kelly.
So there was already some tension there just during the transition when people like Stephen Miller and Steve Bannon and sort of these immigration restrictionists around Trump from the campaign were pressing Kelly to sort of stake out some of the positions that Trump had taken during the campaign in terms of a travel ban and ending asylum for Syrian refugees and the like. But it really flared up in that first week when Trump was in office, when he signed this executive order barring travel to citizens from seven Muslim countries. The order was drawn up pretty much in secret by Miller and Bannon Kelly and his other officials at DHS didn't even get a heads up about it, I think, until a few hours before it was issued. And they're the ones that had to implement it. I mean, they were the ones who, you know, DHS is in charge of Customs and Border Protection, USCIS, which, you know, processes immigration applications and the like. And they were the ones who had to deal with it. And so you had this these scenes of chaos at airports where, you know, you had people coming in, people who were in the air coming in from these countries, and it wasn't really clear how you were going to deal with them. So that was kind of round one,
right?
just right there,
yeah.
In terms of the conflicts between DHS and then people at the White House.
And didn't Stephen Miller want like 24 countries or so to be on that list?
Yeah, so after the initial kind of misfire with the travel ban version 1, you know, the administration regrouped and they issued subsequent travel bans, and there was an effort on the part of Kelly and people at DHS to try to make it a more kind of methodical process by which the U.S. government would determine which countries should be on the list. And Kelly and other people at DHS, they created this methodology by which they would assess individual countries, and you're working with the State Department, working with the intelligence communities, and decide, you know, they had to meet certain criteria to not have restrictions apply. And they created this methodology, and it was supposed to be objective, and they applied it to countries. And, you know, I'm told that Miller was frustrated that the methodology was not producing a longer list. And mm-hmm. He would press for the inclusion of certain countries, many of them African and Asian, arguing that, you know, these are countries that should be on this list. Why are they not on this list? And was trying to get them added to the list. And, you know, people at DHS, I think, fought quite hard to keep those countries off the list. And in the end, they produced a list with 8 countries that were on it. One of them was subsequently taken off, Chad. But Miller lost that fight.
Right. And then, of course, there were all the lawsuits challenging it, and eventually the administration prevailed at the Supreme Court. And you write that this really illustrates their whole policy when it comes to immigration issues, and that is just do it whether or not the law supports it in the moment. We're just going to push on it. If we get sued, we get sued. That's basically the president's policy when it comes to this.
Yeah, well, that's the president's, that's definitely his impulse. I mean, that's, you know, I was talking to someone in the administration, and they were making the case that this stems from his private sector experience, that everything was a negotiation in the private sector and with him, and the first step in that negotiation was usually a lawsuit, and that's the way he approaches policy in the White House. That's definitely his impulse. That has not always been the result, though. I think that there have been a number of times where administration officials have talked him down or walked him back from the edge, trying to explain that, you know, you can't, there really isn't a settlement option when you're breaking federal law. It's not a negotiation like that. So that's been a constant sort of strain and struggle between him and other administration officials.
Right, including Kirstjen Nielsen, who used to run DHS and was forced to resign. So she would really try to push back and say, well, we're not legally allowed to do these things, such as the child separation, what ended up to be a policy, although at first she said there wasn't a policy, but of course there was a de facto policy. So all of this stuff that has erupted into scandal at the border seems to be this push-pull between the agency heads and, you know, his advisors and the president himself.
Yeah, there was a real push-pull there, and, you know, the thing that was interesting was it often focused on kind of process or operational arguments. You know, the president or people like Stephen Miller would want to do certain things like, you know, say a policy of family separation, or say denying asylum to people, you know, just not accepting asylum applications, not processing people. And you would have people at DHS, whether it was Nielsen or Kelly or other people, arguing that, well, we can't actually do that because it's not legal, or because you can't actually, there's no way to sort of operationalize it. I mean, these weren't moral arguments they were making. Mm-hmm. They were largely process arguments. And, you know, I think in a way, I think they would say that they were able to prevent, you know, worse things or more extreme things from happening. But certainly, plenty of things happened that, you know, were previously beyond the pale to both Democratic and Republican administrations. And I think the family separation policy, you know, which which people in the Trump administration would insist was not a family separation policy. It was a zero tolerance policy. That of course resulted in family separation, and I think it was an instance, and probably one of the most extreme instances of the Trump administration kind of creating a crisis of its own, which was, you know, separating these children from their parents and then not being able to reunite them. I mean, the whole thing was just such a operational disaster.
Right. They didn't even keep track of where the kids were or where the parents were after they were separated.
Yeah, and it was just a complete bureaucratic meltdown in ways that, you know, you didn't, the Department of Justice and the Department of Homeland Security and then Department of Health and Human Services, all three of them were not communicating with each other. They weren't all on the same page. No one was keeping track. And, you know, and I think there were probably, and I think, so you had sort of a bureaucratic malfunction on the parts of those departments and agencies. But then you also had, I think, people in the administration, especially in the White House, especially people like Stephen Miller, who they didn't have a problem with family separation. I mean, this is something that they thought should have been a policy from the get-go because they thought it was a deterrent. They thought that it would stop people from trying to mm-hmm. cross the border illegally. And the fact that, you know, the zero tolerance policy, which was something that Jeff Sessions, the Attorney General, pushed for and announced, that sort of served as a backdoor in a way to family separation. And I think that there were people in the administration, you know, at DHS, people like Nielsen, who were arguing that, you know, this is not family separation and this is zero tolerance, and we didn't think it would wind up, we didn't think it would result in family separation. I think there were other people who viewed zero tolerance as a way to get family separation, and that was a real conflict.
Wow. Well, okay, so she's gone. John Kelly is gone. A whole bunch of people are gone from DHS. So what does it look like now, and is Stephen Miller basically running immigration policy?
Yeah, well, DHS looks pretty empty. There's just, you know, after Nielsen got pushed out, a lot of people, a lot of political appointees followed her to the exits. One of the really interesting stories of the Trump administration has been the kind of mainstream Republican political folks who've gone into the administration, who I think have achieved probably more senior positions than they would have been able to achieve under a more regular Republican president. And those people are at DHS. A lot of them have left, and the people who have replaced them have been people who are allied with Miller. Ken Cuccinelli, who's now the head of USCIS, Mark Morgan, who's now the head at CBP, Matt Albans, who's now the acting head at ICE. These are all people who are very much allied with Miller and his viewpoints, and you've seen just in the last couple weeks kind of the result of that, whether it's the authorization for these interior enforcement raids by ICE, or this week the announcement about the new asylum regulations. It's not really clear to what degree these are being kind of pushed to the maximum point at this point, but, you know, these are things that I think under Nielsen and other sort of officials there, they were pushing back on those ideas and those policies much more than the current crop are.
Jason Zingerle, check out his article in the New York Times Magazine, How America Got to Zero Tolerance on Immigration, the inside story. Jason, thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Coming up, a pesticide that's in the same family as sarin gas has been okayed by the EPA to be sprayed on crops. We'll talk about how that happened next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Contradicting itself, the Environmental Protection Agency says it will continue to allow the use of a controversial pesticide to be used on crops. Under President Obama, just 4 years ago, the EPA announced it would ban the use of chlorpyrifos. Research shows it can have harmful effects on children's brains. But now, the Trump administration is saying it can be used. Here to talk about this is Brady Dennis, environmental policy and public health reporter at The Washington Post. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, tell us about this pesticide. What is it and where is it used?
Chlorpyrifos has been used for a really long time. I'd say roughly 50 years or so that this chemical has been around, and it's still very widely used in your state in California. It's used on dozens of crops, strawberries, tree fruits, grapes, broccoli, almonds, you name it. So it's been around for a long time. It's been in use for a long time, and it's also been controversial for quite a long time now.
Right. And so it's been controversial because scientific studies have linked it to harmful effects in children. What exactly has it been found to do?
Yeah, I mean, the science on this is, always evolving and getting better. But, the worry and why a number of a lot of groups want this banned is because it's been linked with potential harm for children, especially effects that can include low birth weight and harmful effects on IQ, neurological effects in children. And so that's why there's been this push in the last couple of decades to try to get this product off the market. It was banned for residential use, around people's homes in the early 2000s, but it's still been allowed to be used on agriculture crops.
And so this is for kids who live near these fields, or just would it be harmful on food that we eat?
I think the concern is both. I think the more immediate worry is, children who live near farms or the families of farm workers, this chemical can come home on, clothing or hands or whatever else it may be. And I think the worry is any kind of exposure that anyone can have to it, but especially younger children.
Okay, so that's why the Obama administration, EPA, proposed banning this pesticide 4 years ago. Was there a lot of pushback on the part of industry?
Yeah, I mean, the industry has said all along and continues to say that, this is an important tool for farmers, that they use it sparingly in most cases, and that there are all these other restrictions about where they can use it and measures that workers need to abide by when they're applying this, but they certainly haven't agreed to have it taken off the market. So there's been this tug of war over what will happen with this chemical, and this just seems to be the latest turn in that fight, which has really gone on for almost two decades now.
And this is made by Dow, is that right?
Yeah, it's primarily made by Dow, by a division of Dow known as Corteva. That's the biggest producer of this chemical now, and that's what they've said. That's what they said when we talked to them for the story yesterday, was that this is something that they're open to listening to more data and more research as it comes along. But for now, they think it's safe if used the way it's intended.
Right. And so it's interesting that EPA's own recommendation, they looked at the science 4 years ago and said, no, we're going to ban this. But now, did they look at the science in a different way, or did they just decide with the other side?
So this all goes back to a petition that environmental and public health groups filed, saying to the EPA, you have the evidence to ban this pesticide, do it. And they sued over it as well and forced the EPA to make a decision. And the Obama administration looked at the evidence that was out there and said, we agree that the evidence is there to ban this pesticide. But the Trump administration came in and looked at the same evidence and said, there are gaps in this evidence. The questions remain about how significant this data is and whether it's robust enough to ban this chemical. And so they made the other decision and said, we don't have enough information to ban it. Now, just real quickly, I mean, that the groups who sued over this would say the standard, the law says that you have to prove that a pesticide is safe, not that it's not safe. So, I don't think we've probably seen the last of the legal fight over this either.
Well, speaking of, California was in the process of banning it. So what does this mean for California's efforts?
I mean, I believe it means that the California can go forward right now with what it's planning. I think it's going to take a couple of years, if I recall, for that to take effect. Other states have done that as well, Hawaii being one. New York just passed legislation. There's a handful of other states, Connecticut, Oregon, I think New Jersey, that are also considering taking this off the market. So I think a lot of folks think it's going to be a matter of time before chlorpyrifos no longer is on the market, but certainly it's not weeks or months, but probably years.
Hmm. Well, it's interesting that you have the states, like also with the CAFE standards for cars and air pollution, you have the states enacting these rules or these bans or what have you, and now in contradiction to what the federal government wants to do. But yet when you have a state like California, which is so large, can it de facto set policy for the rest of the nation? So if California says, we're going to ban this, the use of this pesticide, will it just be economically not feasible for this company to keep producing this pesticide?
Well, certainly it matters what states do it. And just as with you mentioned, you know, cars and fuel standards for cars, California is a really big and important state in this area. You know, if I have my numbers right, I think, you know, there's about 1 million pounds, maybe a little bit under 1 million pounds of this pesticide that gets applied each year in California. That used to be higher. It's been going down, but it's certainly one of the biggest states where this is applied. And so if that state, if California were to ban this pesticide, New York as well, and you know, some big agricultural states, eventually it's probably the market for it disappears.
Brady Dennis, environmental policy and public health reporter for The Washington Post. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, that bonkers trailer for the Cats movie with human actors CGI'd as cats.
They're meant to be the size of cats, so they're leaping around on gigantic furniture, for instance, which is something out of a nightmare. It really is visually disturbing.
We'll talk about that and the movies out this weekend, including The Lion King, with our film critics. That's coming up next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Movies this summer have really been taking us back to the 90s. First, there was the Aladdin remake, then Men in Black, Detective Pokemon, Toy Story 4. This weekend, The Lion King is back. It's Friday, so let's talk about new movies with Katie Walsh and Whitney Seibold. Katie Walsh reviews films for the Tribune News Service and the Los Angeles Times. Welcome back.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks. And Whitney Seibold contributes to IGN and co-hosts the podcast Critically Acclaimed. Hello.
Good day.
Okay, we're going to save The Lion King for last.
So, fitting.
Yes, fitting, because mm-hmm. King of the Beasts at the end. Let's start with the Netflix original. It's called Secret Obsession.
Your husband's here to see you.
What happened? I mean, how did I get here?
Jennifer, you were in an accident and you hit your head. You don't remember me, do you?
I don't even know your name.
I'm Russell. It's really nice to meet you.
Wait, is this Lifetime or Netflix?
It is one step above a Lifetime movie and like three steps below a 90s thriller. So,
what is the plot here? Is there one?
Well, yes. I mean, a woman is in a terrible accident and then a man shows up at the hospital. She has amnesia, obviously. And he's like, we're married. I'm your husband. And takes her home and she starts to realize that things are not what they seem.
Okay, you can see the whole movie in the trailer.
Oh, you totally can. And I also don't think the movie even hides the fact that this guy is like not who he says he is. Like you, from the minute one, you're like, oh, he's super sketchy.
There are no surprises. You know the entire plot from beginning to end. Even Dennis Haysbert as the detective can't really bring a lot of life to the proceedings. I've seen the movie Shattered. I've seen several Lifetime movies with the same plot as this. I'm not exactly sure why they felt they needed to make this. Clearly, they haven't seen a lot of movies before.
There's something kind of pleasurable, though, about knowing that it's going to go there and then, like, watching it fulfill its prophecy. Like, I enjoyed watching this movie because it's like there's something like generic pleasure that you get out of being like, and then he's going to totally kill that guy. And then he does. And you're like, yes, I was right.
You're like, I could have made this.
Right, exactly.
It's like watching a Law and Order rerun.
Yeah.
That's some sort of comforting soup.
It's a little, it is comforting.
Why is Netflix doing this? Just because it can and someone will
watch
it?
You know, I was thinking about this as well. Like, why are they doing this? You know, Hollywood studios are not making these kinds of thrillers anymore. Someone's got to do it, I guess. I think what's interesting about it is that the guy, Russell, the bad husband, fake husband, he uses this kind of like nice guy rhetoric of like, I would be such a great husband for you. Why aren't you with me? That actually felt quite a little bit topical to me, you know, with sort of like what's going on in the world. There was like a murder on Monday of a young girl who was murdered by a guy who was in the incel community. And he was sort of like, I deserve you and I'm entitled to you. So it does kind of touch on some stuff that's actually out there, even though it's pretty over the top.
Well, the incel community took a lot of their rhetoric from the bad characters in movies like this. So to hear it again is it makes it feel a lot more topical. Brenda Song plays the lead actress, and it's nice to have an Asian lead in a thriller like this. It's sort of a thankless role, but she does.
But I imagine eventually she gets away and
she does.
She's bloody but alive.
She limps away from the bad guy screaming, but the bad guy is apprehended.
I actually, what I appreciate about this, usually these movies require some, like the main character to be so incredibly clueless and like trusting. And you're like, why do you believe this person? And like, I will say that Brenda Song is pretty sharp, but she's just trapped in this house because she's injured and in a wheelchair and like has no cell phone service. But
really remote.
You know, she's not totally dumb.
Okay, not totally dumb, which might be the theme for this week's movie segment.
A good pull quote for the poster. Yeah. Not totally dumb. Yeah.
All right, speaking of not totally dumb, or maybe not totally dumb, maybe totally dumb, Into the Ashes. It's a thriller starring Frank Grillo and Luke Grimes.
Man can only see so much darkness before he goes blind. In the end, he didn't have to see the monster he became.
Whitney, sounds deep, and yet?
And yet not quite so deep. the Luke Grimes character, he's a former scumbag who's served some time in prison, has betrayed people long in the past, but has now settled into sort of a new wimpy life with his wife. And then Frank Grillo appears out of his past and starts riling things up again, tries to get him involved, and the violence re-enters his life very quickly. The Luke Grimes character is constantly told that he is not man enough to do any of the things that he's doing. He's not man enough to live with this woman. He's not man enough to be part of the old crew again. It's clearly trying to be a very earnest analysis of masculinity in these sort of hard-boiled crime detective thrillers.
That is the theme of the summer.
It really is. And it seems that this also might be a movie the incels would appreciate.
Perhaps, but the Luke Grimes character is depicted as being roundly pathetic and doesn't really get what he wants out of this situation. He's not a heroic incel. He is a pathetic character.
Is it also trying to make some comment on rural America and vanished opportunity and masculinity under siege?
Indeed it is. But no more or less so than many other films of this genre, the sort of Alabama noir, which I've seen many films.
Is that an actual term?
It is now.
Yeah. Okay. Finally, the highly anticipated return of The Lion King.
Simba, you must remember who you are. The one true king.
Okay, Katie, do we want to see this remake?
I really did not enjoy this Lion King remake. It saps all the joy and fun out of the original movie, which isn't really a very joyful movie. It's very tragic. My larger issues with it, I mean, I have some micro issues with it, but the larger scale issue is just that, like, big cats can't carry Hamlet. I'm sorry, but they just, they can't. And so we have these hyper-realistic simulacra of wildlife. So you feel like you're watching Planet Earth, and then they do Shakespeare. And it's like, you can't get the
it's
kind of...
It's too weird for animals to be spouting off.
It is very weird. And also, you know, the sort of stretches of imagination that you have to do to get into this world, which is that, you know, from the very beginning, even that glorious opening where they all celebrate the young predator king being born, I was like, zebras, he's going to eat you in a couple of years. What are you doing? Stop bowing to him. Like, so, you know, we're supposed to sort of buy into this like realism of the animals and then also
the fantasy that they don't act like animals.
Exactly.
But, so it's better that they were, when they were animated, the line was starker.
Yeah, you could, in the hand-drawn animation, it's more fantastical. So you can kind of go into that world. And there's a reason why they put eyebrows and eyelashes and big toothy smiles on animals when they draw them, because they have these elastic human faces to express emotion. And you just don't get that with realistic animals. So this was not for me. I did not have fun with it.
Whitney?
I very much agreed.
Okay, good.
yeah, there was this weird thesis that the director, Jon Favreau, was going for. He wanted to make the animals as real as possible. You can make a CGI animal with an expressive face. You can maybe do a motion capture on a human actor and try to project that like Jon Favreau did with The Jungle Book. Mm-hmm. Here he's just trying to make realistic cat faces, and realistic cat faces aren't expressive. And what's more, they cast a cast of non-voice actors. They're better known for their on-screen work, which means they're not bringing a lot of vocal expression to the animals as well. So what we have is a lot of half-assed line reading superimposed over documentary footage, which evokes not so much The Lion King as it does a lot of the 1950s Disney nature shorts.
You have to expect John Attenborough or David Attenborough, whatever his name is.
I would rather have David Attenborough.
Or Richard Attenborough.
Oh, Richard. Dave, John.
One of the Attenboroughs.
One of the Attenboroughs.
Attenborough.
And in this scene, Simba is seen relaxing
that
in
would have
the
been great.
Sun. You know, it would have been a better rendition.
I will also say that they managed to tack on 32 minutes to the running time of The Lion King, and I don't know with what. They don't. It's a line-for-line, almost exact remake, and it's so long and tedious. I'm like, it's not even that the musical numbers are long or are longer. They're kind of the same, and then it's like, how is this still going on?
there's one moment I enjoyed that they padded it out. There's a scene where the animals are just sort of strolling through the forest, because that's all they do. They can't dance or express or emote in this version of things. But they're singing The Lion Sleeps Tonight.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a moment where the film just gets to breathe for a little bit. The characters just get to be themselves. That is one mercifully short moment in this gigantic, clunky, overblown, badly designed, kind of difficult to watch blockbuster.
Speaking of feline renditions,
oh my
God, we have to talk about the Cats trailer. And here's a snippet. Okay, this movie's not coming out till Christmas, right? So we are seeing this trailer.
We have 6 months to prepare ourselves.
People were going berserk for this trailer.
Well, people were going berserk before the trailer even came out, just anticipating, because there have been some featurettes and some interviews where Tom Hooper said that they were going to do a realistic digital fur covering on the actors.
So the actors, and they are great actors.
Sir Ian McKellen and Dame Judi Dench and Idris Elba. This pretty wonderful cast.
And they're dressed up as cats, sort of.
Well, they put them in the motion capture wetsuits and then added
a motion
realistic
capture wetsuit with like their head sticking out.
Yeah, so they're realistic faces superimposed on this weird, fuzzy, reduced size cat head.
So I think what we've realized here is that actual realistic cats can't express, but having human faces digitally imposed on cat bodies might be even more terrifying. Is that what we're coming
That's
to?
That's what we're coming
yeah.
to. That's definitely what we're coming to, because just watching this, it's pretty disturbing. Also, they change sizes, it seems. Sometimes they're small and sometimes they're big.
Right.
They're meant to be the size of cats, so they're leaping around on gigantic furniture, for instance, which is something out of a nightmare. It really is visually disturbing. It's not even an Uncanny Valley thing. It's just a bad aesthetic decision.
I think the choreography looks really cool. And the main actress, or the new white cat, is a ballet dancer from the Royal Ballet named, I can't remember her name at the moment, but the dancing should be good.
Yeah, and it's the choreographer from Hamilton. Tom Hooper is...
He directed really the King's Speech.
He doesn't strike me as somebody who can handle like a digital cat dancing type of film, but I suppose we'll see. It looks ugly as sin, but we'll have to hold our tongues until the actual feature film comes out.
Can I say the cat got your tongue?
You may.
Thank you. And we'll end there. Whitney Seibold contributes to IGN. He co-hosts the podcast Critically Acclaimed. Katie Walsh reviews films for the Tribune News Service and the Los Angeles Times. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you. Meow, 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 meow. Meow, 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 meow. Meow, meow,
meow, meow, meow. And joining us now is Warren Olney with a preview of To the Point, the podcast. Hello.
Hello. We're going to be talking about whether false reports, fake news, can in fact lead to real war. This has happened many, many times in American history, all the way back to Paul Revere, who distorted facts to create the Boston Massacre. And then we come forward to Vietnam and the war in Iraq as well. And we're going to be taking a look at this in the context of relations between the United States and Iran, with hawks on both sides looking for whatever they can find. And available to them now, technology that allows distortion of facts in a very persuasive way. Could that lead to a war? We're also going to take a look on our climate change update on how the Trump administration is still pushing scientists out of Washington and away from Congress, where they'll never be heard.
Wow. So good news, in other words.
Well, good news, bad news. You know, it's always good news. Maybe you can do something about it, even if it's bad.
All right, Warren Olney, To the Point, the podcast. Download it wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you, Warren.
Okay.
Coming up, humans don't even need to be dressed as cats to be scary. They can just speak. How human voices are scaring off big predators and disrupting delicate eco-webs. Next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Bears, wolves, mountain lions, they are some of the fiercest predators on Earth. But there's one thing that terrifies them all.
What I have here is a copy of Donald Trump's tax returns. We have his federal tax
returns. I hate this story. I despise this story. Yeah, I'm only
two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by.
Yes, it's the human voice. A new study found that when researchers played Rachel Maddow, Rush Limbaugh, or even gentle poetry, as we just heard, those voices sent predators running for the hills. And that has ripple effects throughout the entire ecosystem. Ed Yong wrote about this for The Atlantic, and he's here now. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, what is it about the human voice that makes animals so afraid?
So, you know, it's not about the qualities of the voice in particular. It's what the voice signifies, which is the presence of humans. Humans are, sadly, exceptionally great at killing other animals and other species, including even the top fiercest predators in the world, seem to have developed this very intense fear of us, so that even the sound of people will send these predators scurrying off into other parts of the hills.
And is it just because they aren't used to the voice? Because when you think of, I think of the animals in my backyard, like raccoons, skunks, they don't seem that terrified of me when I'm speaking.
Right. So what was interesting about this study, so this was work done by a guy called Justin Siracci and his team. They put up speakers in this area of wilderness and played the sounds of human voices. And they then looked at how different animals reacted. So they had camera traps, they had GPS collars on things like mountain lions. And what was really interesting, I think, is that even the the animals that you would think would be well habituated to humans, like skunks, like you say, or opossums, behave differently. Like sometimes they didn't run away, but they would react. They would reduce their foraging time, or they would be very wary, or they would show signs of being disturbed or stressed.
And even that was different than when their natural predator would be around and making noise?
Right. So in this particular study, they only compared a human speech with the sound of frogs. So another quite loud animal, but clearly one that doesn't pose much of a threat. Mm. But there have been previous work by the same team where they went, for example, to England and they played the sounds of lots of different predators to badgers. And things like dogs and bears made them wary. Wolves didn't make them do anything, but humans terrified them.
How do they know that, though, even if they haven't had direct experience with human violence? These animals seem to be scared off by the human voice. How do they know?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So it might be that they learn. So mountain lions, for example, will spend a large part of their early lives in walking around with their mothers. So they might learn something about the threat that humans pose in that way. It might be innate. I mean, humans have persecuted mountain lions, carnivores, other predators for a very long time. And it might be that the ones that have survived this long are the ones with some kind of innate predisposition to moving away or to behaving more watchfully when they hear things that sound like human speech. But it's not clear. I think that's a really good question.
Hmm. Well, what about when you are taking a hike in the mountains and maybe you're by yourself or just with one other person and there are big predators out there? Shouldn't you be talking a little bit to scare them off in case they might come upon the trail and surprise you?
Right. I mean, it's often said that people should talk loudly in order to make yourself like audible to potential predators out there for exactly that reason, to put them off. Now, sure, that works for us, but I think we just need to be cognizant of the fact that when we do go out into wild spaces, our voices have powerful effects, whether we see those effects or not. Now, that's not to say that people should avoid wild areas. I think it is important more than ever, actually, for us to experience nature and have a connection with it. But I think it might benefit everyone if we all maybe kept our voices down a bit.
And so when these animals are scared off, how does that have a trickle-down effect on the rest of the ecosystem?
Right. So the mountain lions fled. Other of the smaller, medium-sized predators like bobcats and skunks were warier or reduced their foraging. And interestingly, the only animals that then benefited were the mice and rats, because their predators were too busy keeping watch or moving into other areas. And so they kind of used the voices in this experiment as a figurative human shields. So it's not that we're scaring away all animals. We're actually creating some nice conditions for things like mice and rats.
Oh, which is maybe an unintended consequence that we don't want.
Right, right, right.
It seems like we're doing a lot of things that are maybe unintended or intended and having these effects that we don't necessarily want on nature.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, there's a long list of things that humans do aside from the really obvious stuff like hunting or destroying habitat. I think those are very clear. But we also have a huge number of effects on wildlife that we might be unaware of. The light from our cities and from our homes drives animals away. The sound from our roads and our cities stops them from communicating, from hearing each other's mating calls. And now you have things like this about how the presence of humans creates what ecologists call a landscape of fear, a very pervasive kind of simmering unease in the wild creatures around us. And I think we really need to start becoming more aware of those effects, so we might best think about how to better coexist with the natural world.
Ed Yong, he covers science for The Atlantic. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Michelle Alloy is here now. Cats aficionado.
So much great cat content out there.
There's a lot of cat
right
content.
Now. So much.
And I embrace it.
Expertise cat content. We asked people if they were going to check out The Lion King this week. Super hyped movie, though not getting the best reviews
for
our critics. Just a Crow says not going to see it because it's a copyright scam for Disney. Jay Blackshear just says meh, period. Gotcha Punky says, I'm not sure yet. The original Lion King was one of my favorites. All the live action remakes are cool and all, but don't think it's worth the admission price to see it. And Messy Elliot says, I don't really care. I'm only watching it for Beyonce, Giselle Knowles Carter. We have to stand, period.
Okay, but maybe everyone's going to stay home and watch the cat
just
trailer
on repeat
in
this like horrifying
sort of dark.
Because
that's very entertaining.
I have a lot of questions. Namely, I don't understand the proportions. Like, how can they sit in this large chair, reach the table, but hold a knife that is like almost the whole size of them? That doesn't make any sense. Why are some of them in clothes and others not in clothes?
What, some of them are naked?
Yeah, there's the white cat.
Oh, just in the fur.
Right, exactly. Yeah. But then like Idris Elba has the clothes. Oh,
here we go.
It's our time. It's our song. It's so great. I mean, I could watch it in horror forever.
Excellent. All right, well, we'll leave you on that note. Thank you, Michelle Alloy. That's it for our show. Our producers are Michelle Alloy, Alex Trigvadottir, Rosalie Atkinson, Brian Hardzinski, Adriana Cargill, and Rebecca Mooney. Sarah Sweeney is our managing producer. Amy Ta, our digital producer. Mario Saavedra is our technical director. I'm Madeline Brand. Meow, 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 meow. See you on Monday. Be a great big kitty cat. Use open windows to go from flat.